the National Weather Service. Mostly cloudy today and tonight. A chance of rain this afternoon. A high of 42. An overnight low of 31 tomorrow. Partly sunny. A high of 43. The five-day weather trend calls for temperatures holding in the 40s with more rain on tap for Thursday night and Friday morning. Right now, 38. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a largely forgotten story that involves something that took place at a research facility back in 1997, and something that, in a sense, would seem to have nothing to do with the current day. And yet, because of this incident that occurred at the Brookhaven National Laboratory, a small leak of radioactive material, which caused a media sensation, that facility was ultimately closed. And in a sense, the legacy left behind by this incident resonates with us to this very day. That is the contention of the author of a fascinating new book called The Leak: Politics, Activists, and Loss of Trust at Brookhaven National Laboratory. The author, Dr. Robert Kreese, is professor of philosophy and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook University, and the author of this really interesting book about which we will talk for the next few minutes. Professor Kreese, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the book.
I'm very curious, first of all, to know how it is that you even became aware of this incident, which occurred back in 1997. Is this something about which you had direct awareness at the time that it occurred?
Well, yes, I did. At the time, I was working on a history of the labs of Brookhaven National Laboratory's first 25 years. Now, you know, it was a historic laboratory. It was one of the first national laboratories that was founded after World War II to house, you know, scientific instruments had suddenly zoomed in size and cost. And Brookhaven was one of three national laboratories that were founded in order to build and maintain these instruments so that people from scientists from all across the country could use them. So I was working, so the first 25 years are very important in the story of U.S. science. And I was completing this book about that, and suddenly these events that are described in the book happened, and I couldn't believe them. You know, a small leak of material that the state, the feds, and locals said was not hazardous. It didn't get in, didn't pose any danger. It didn't get into the drinking water. Suddenly, this caused a firestorm that closed the facility and caused to close the lab itself. And I was, but I thought nobody would believe this story. There were conspiracy theories floating around. these conspiracy theories damaged important scientific instruments. There were, you know, protests with people dressed up and who got on the media with lurid costumes. There were politicians who listened to celebrities rather than scientists. There were celebrities who became politicians. There, one thing after another, and I thought nobody would believe this. You know, this is just too implausible. So I didn't do anything about it, but two decades later, it didn't seem so strange to me.
In other words, this, I think what you're suggesting is that what happened around this event in 1997 was perhaps something of a precursor to the climate in which we find ourselves today. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. It's sort of, you might call it what happened in 1997 at Brookhaven on Long Island is the canary in the coal mine for what's happening today. And even more so, because you see in this one episode, you see things come into play that are around today, but you see them more clearly in this episode.
Before we proceed to talk about what happened back in 1997, tell us a little more about the significance of the Brookhaven National Laboratory. Explain what kind of work they were doing and the significance of that work.
Well, right after World War II, as I said, there were a lot scientific instruments had suddenly zoomed its size. In particular, you needed things like research reactors and accelerators to study things like the structure of metals, to image biological substances, to create medical isotopes for, you know, medical diagnoses and treatment. These instruments were too large for single universities to afford, and so a group of Northeastern universities got together to found this laboratory. It was for not classified or not military research. So, you know, they didn't make weapons or anything. It was non-military research. And let me explain. An important thing is the difference between power reactors and research reactors. You know, reactors, because often they get confused or associated, and that was part of the story that happened. Nuclear reactors make vast quantities of two things. One is heat and the other is neutrons. And what power reactors do is to keep the heat and throw away the neutrons. And they use the heat they turn the heat into energy. Whereas research reactors, which are a lot smaller by 30 times or so, research reactors throw out the heat and keep the neutrons and use them for research, because neutrons can pass through materials very easily and so allow you to image things like metals and other solids. But they also create radioisotopes that you need for medical research. And so this became a very essential place. The research reactor was an important element in United States science. And the first one was built at Brookhaven. It was called the Brookhaven Graphite Research Reactor. That was closed down after 20 years. And the second one was the facility that whose fate the book is about, called the High Flux Beam Reactor. High flux, meaning it had a particularly large amount of neutrons, and beam, meaning that these neutrons were carried out from the reactor in beams to various pieces of instrument.
Incidentally, what is a professor of philosophy doing in the midst of all this? I must say I'm impressed at how much you have brought yourself up to speed. Maybe in a previous life or a previous chapter of your professional life, you were actually engaged in this kind of scientific material, or is it that you have had to bring yourself up to speed in order to have this kind of comprehensive understanding of what they were doing at Brookhaven?
Well, that's a good question, and I think about it all the time. It happened in an odd way. I was in graduate school. I was, in graduate school in philosophy at Columbia University. And to sort of make some money and to entertain myself, I began to write articles with my college roommate, who's a writer. His name is Charles Mann. Have you heard of him? He wrote the book 1490, 1491 and 1493. Yes. He's an excellent writer. He was my college roommate. And he proposed we write some articles about the nearby scientific facilities and developments. And so in grad school already, I started writing about places like Brookhaven and other scientific developments. So when I became a professor of philosophy at Stony Brook, I continued to have an interest in what was happening at in contemporary physics and at Brookhaven. And I began to turn towards, in the philosophy of science, I began to turn towards the relation between science and society. You know, how is scientific information generated? How is it received? How is it used in policy? What are its social effects? That kind of thing. And I think that's incredibly important, because if you think about it, all of the existential issues facing, you know, the world today have a scientific dimension in them. You know, global warming, pandemics, toxins, those sorts of things. So it's an incredibly important philosophical issue. What is the relation between science and society? Hmm. And that's the that's what keeps me in the field. So writing with Charles Mann got me into the subject, and philosophical interests keep me in it.
Fantastic.
But yes, you're right. I had to come up to speed. It took me a while to come up to speed, but I'm still getting there.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Robert Kreese, professor and chair of the philosophy department at Stony Brook University and the author of a new book called The Leak. Let's talk about exactly the leak. What leaked out of this Brookhaven National Laboratory back in 1997, something called tritium. Tell us what that is, how this leak occurred, and kind of the reality of what actually occurred in this moment.
Okay, another good question. Tritium is an isotope of hydrogen. It's got, ordinary hydrogen, like in H2O in water, has one proton in the nucleus. Tritium has a proton plus two neutrons, and it's slightly radioactive. It's what scientists call a small beta, a soft beta emitter. Its rays can be stopped by a single piece of paper, and its half-life is 12 and a half years, so, eventually it decays. But it's considered so safe that it's used in self-illuminating exit signs in buildings. Have you ever seen those, Greg? They were put in a lot of buildings after the World Trade Center bombing, the first one, so that you don't need electricity. They're self-illuminating. And they're used in some self-illuminating watches. Hydrogeologists sometimes put tritium in water to track in groundwater to track its flow. So that's what tritium is. Now, in the reactor, you have fuel elements in the core, and when they get used up, they're taken out and put in a pool of water so that they cool down and to prepare them for reprocessing to send them off site. So there's like a swimming pool next to the reactor. So you put the fuel rods in this swimming pool, and the swimming pool eventually gets a certain amount of tritium. And this swimming pool, which is about 10 feet across and 40 feet long and maybe 40 feet deep, I don't know, I'm not sure I have the exact dimensions, but they're in the book. This big swimming pool, it slowly acquires a certain amount of tritium. And after a while, this tritium began to leak into the surrounding water. So it was a relatively small amount. It was about 30, what the scientists call curies, which is about the amount in one of those exit signs that I mentioned. And the thing was, the Brookhaven scientists didn't discover it for 12 years. But when they discovered it, the tritium was not in the drinking water. It was it wasn't in the drinking water either for the employees at the laboratory or people offsite. But it was there, and so the lab wasn't entirely innocent in that the scientists hadn't discovered the leak for 12 years. But the reaction was partly justified because if scientists said that everything was safe and the pool wasn't leaking, and suddenly they say the pool is leaking, that's a cause for distrust. But the leak was not dangerous, and the news of the leak got caught up in a lot of political and social agendas, anti-nuclear agendas, and the incredible twists and turns of the story that followed. Are what the book is about. And eventually that, as I said, led to the closure of the reactor and calls to close the Brookhaven National Laboratory itself.
Just to for further clarification, or just to confirm what you were just saying, when it comes to the amount of danger of actual hazard that this in fact posed to the community or surrounding community and environment, essentially the answer to that question is zero. Is that correct?
Yes, it was zero, and it was zero as confirmed by federal, state, local environmental authorities, the Environmental Protection Agency, that sort of thing. Absolutely zero. And there's some incredible ironies in the story. Let me just tell you one. Nearby in New Jersey, a teenager, after a prom or something, happened to go to a landfill, saw one of those exit signs, thought it was really cool, because they are cool, opened it up and wound up ingesting some of the tritium. And then he noticed the diagram of radioactive material, went to his doctor, and the doctor examined him and said quite accurately, you're okay, there's no danger. And sent the kid home and told him to drink lots of water and pee it out. So, but his pee, the teenager's pee, had a higher concentration of tritium than the plume itself. So you have these two events: the Brookhaven plume, which was causing a political firestorm, and this teenager who had ingested a lot of tritium, who was safe. That's one of the ironies in the book.
So trace for us the explosion of concern, which it, more than once in your book, I think, is characterized as a political firestorm. Trace for us first just kind of the essential timeline of how quickly and to what scale all of this sort of exploded in terms of public and political concern / outrage.
Okay, I'll give you a few dates. Tell me if you want me to fill in. The leak was announced at the middle of January 1997. The Department of Energy then fired the contractor in May of 1997. The two local politicians, Senator D'Amato and Michael Forbes, introduced legislation to terminate the reactor in September. A new contractor appointed by the Department of Energy took over the beginning of 1998, and the HFBR, the reactor itself, was terminated in the fall of 1999.
So all of these events overtake Brookhaven and its staff in kind of bewildering speed. One of the points...
Let me say, too, that this was the lab's 50th year. So remember, the laboratory had, at this time, had its research at it had been awarded 4 Nobel Prizes, which is more than any other laboratory any place in the equivalent amount of time. So it's 50, in beginning of 1997, laboratory is 50 years old. It's about to celebrate, it's half centennial, and thinks the year is going to be full of celebration. and instead it's full of total chaos and even calls to close it.
Do I remember correctly from your book that many of the scientists on hand were that many of the scientists on hand were rather neophytes when it comes to, I mean, for instance, handling sort of media outcries and so on?
Oh, absolutely. And that was a part of the problem. I mean, right after World War II, scientists, especially physicists, had a huge amount of prestige. The theoretical physicists were their photographs were appearing in Forbes magazine and things like that. And when the laboratory was established, it was a federal facility, meaning that technically the it was exempt from local environmental laws. So it operated as a kind of independent facility for all those 50 years. I mean, it didn't really have to obey local environmental regulations. So there was a kind of aloofness that was there. Also, the community relations was not as developed as they are today. I mean, a lot of, if there were community concerns, some scientists would go out and speak to the public, but their tone was like their tone was to view these opportunities as teaching sessions. You know, here's what's really happening. Don't worry, you have nothing to fear. If you fear what's happening at the lab, you're being irrational. You don't know enough, and of course that was that just caused people to think they were being patronized, to people that their fears were being dismissed. This was exactly the wrong thing to do. So there was as you said, there was kind of a dynamic going on in which the scientists weren't very effective at communicating with a public who was concerned about what was happening in the laboratory.
Right. And of course, probably one of the things we should say is that some degree of public concern certainly understandable, especially when we think about incidents that have occurred in which the truth was not told, and things that should have caused great concern or great alarm were kind of brushed under the rug or out and out lied about, and even scientific facilities and scientists are not immune to some of those temptations. So it's not as though it was a completely preposterous proposition that something terrible happened and they're afraid to tell us or too cowardly to tell us. And so that is part of what we are talking about here. I mean, that this was a possibility, an unsettling possibility, and people, in a sense, took that possibility and ran with it.
Oh, absolutely. In several respects. First of all, as I said, the lab wasn't innocent. The laboratory scientists had been assuring the public that everything was safe regarding the reactor. It was being carefully monitored. And then this leak was discovered, and it had been leaking for 12 years. So if they were wrong about that, what else might they be wrong about? That's one thing. Another thing is the particular character of radiation. You know, there's some risks that you and I take, but we take them voluntarily. You know, driving has a certain risk to it, or, you know, smoking has a certain risk to it. Running across the jaywalking, which I do all the time, has a certain risk to it. But I take it myself, and it affects only me. But other risks are invisible, like radiation. I can't, the world is, there's natural background radiation all the time, but it's invisible. Radiation is invisible. So, and there's, it's sort of rational to fear invisible kinds of hazards that you can't smell or taste or hear. And so you ought to have a larger amount of concern for that than what you see in the data books.
There were a couple of different elements to this firestorm, and one of them was the activity of politicians who, in a sense, took this fear and took this situation and really spun political gold out of it, in a sense. It's easy to look at that and assume that that was done essentially for political gain. How would you assess the motives of the legion of politicians who stepped forward expressing concern and even anger about this? I mean, was any of the response of politicians springing from legitimate, sincere fear, or in your opinion, was the vast majority of this at least opportunistic in nature?
Well, you know, that's part of the story, is it's ambiguous. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, there was a lot of opportunism. There was political gold, as you said. I mean, Senator Alphonse D'Amato at the time was going to be facing an election, a re-election. He had squeaked past the last election with about with less than 1% of the vote. And he had, at a time of increasing environmental sensitivities, he had zero environmental credentials. And I mean that literally. The League of Conservation Voters ranked him zero in terms of his, 0% in terms of his voting.
Wow.
But on the other hand, you know, politicians are supposed to represent their constituency. And what D'Amato heard was loud voices around him saying, look, we have to do something about this. So, you know, it's not entirely, he was looking for environmental credentials. On the other hand, very, very vocal constituents were saying you have to do something about this. Mm. Now, when the reactor was ultimately terminated, you know, Department of Energy Secretary was Bill Richardson, and I asked him, you know, point blank, why did you terminate the reactor when it was entirely safe? And he said to me, look, I'm a politician. I listen to the people around me. And while the scientists were saying that the reactor should be kept open, there were a lot of voices around him saying that that it shouldn't be. And even the scientists in the Department of Energy, in his own department, were saying, you know, look, this is... we're getting weary of this. We have to. We're sort of lukewarm because it's costing a lot of money, and we might be able to use this money for other things. So part of it is political opportunism, but part of it is also that politicians listen to what's going on around them. So it's an ambiguous story. I mean, it was a firestorm, but it's a firestorm that had. That had its own fuel.
Right. And I appreciate how thoroughly and I think how fairly you tell this side of the story. You, of course, also talk about the media, who, of course, in a sense, were the gasoline that were poured on the flame of this controversy. And one of the things you talk about in your book is the sensationalist language with which this incident was described and discussed. And you say, while such language would have been appropriate to Chernobyl, Bhopal, and the Challenger launch disasters, it was not to the BNL leak. That's probably a really important distinction, which, in a sense, nobody was making back in 1997. That is, to write about this as if it were a disaster of the scope of those that I just mentioned, that is just not right.
Well, yes, that's a, and that's one of the elements that you see around us today that shocked me at the time, but is less shocking to me now, which is the use of extreme rhetoric. Remember, I said the tritium leak was not a health hazard as certified by federal, state, and local authorities. It wasn't getting into drinking water. It would eventually all decay. But activists and media were using extreme rhetoric, like saying that this is Long Island's Chernobyl, that this is the, you know, the Three Mile Island and that sort of thing. So it's a kind, you know, we see that today, extreme rhetoric being applied into situations where it's not particularly appropriate.
There's all kinds of other elements of this story that we could talk about, but one that we should, I think, address just briefly is the matter of the DOE, the Department of Energy. And there are those who, particularly in hindsight, have issue with the way in which the Department of Energy handled this, and in particular, their failure to do anything significant to try to quiet the fears of the community and the public about this so-called health hazard. What is your assessment of the DOE's response to this?
Well, again, it's ambiguous. Whose responsibility is it to quiet huge concerns by members of the surrounding communities? Is it the Department of Energy, which is located in Washington, and which runs laboratories all over the United States? Or is it the contractor of Brookhaven, the manager, Associated Universities, Inc., that was located in D.C., but also ran the laboratory? Or was it the laboratory itself? So it's kind of unclear who's responsible for handling those concerns. Mm. So that's another part of this firestorm, is that there wasn't one person whose job it was to pour water over the fire.
Mm. In our last minute, what would you say is the most important significance of this story when it comes to the present day? Is it that this event is somehow resonating to this day in terms of affecting current events, or is it more that it helps point the way to where we are today?
I think the latter. I mean, part of the lesson to me was at the very end, as you saw, I asked about 24 people what the lessons of this event were, and I got 24 different responses. And we really want to look for a single, tweak that we could do to keep it from happening again, but there isn't that tweak. And so it's the loss of sync between the laboratory and the environment was the important cause. So that all it took would be a single slip up to cause everything to collapse. So I think what this is as I said, a canary in the coal mine. It was a kind of warning to say, look, this thing might happened here, and it might happen again. So I don't think it shows us a solution, but but 25 years ago, it showed us something that did in fact grow and is happening today.
Right, and could and something very much like it could certainly happen again, and in some respects is already happening in terms of other issues related to the scientific community. The distrust which a large swath of the public has towards the scientific community and what we do about it. A lot of provocative, fascinating questions posed in your really interesting book, again called The Leak, Politics, Activists, and Loss of Trust at Brookhaven National Laboratory. The book is published by MIT Press, and one of its authors, Robert Kreese. Professor Kreese, it was a great pleasure for me to speak with you about this fascinating story, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show archives. We are spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show probing into one of the most frustrating mysteries of the late 20th century, namely the assassination in February of 1986 of Olof Palme, who was at the time Prime Minister of Sweden. one of the only times in recent history in which a head of state was murdered, and there was essentially no suspect, no clue left as to who was responsible for such a terrible crime. One of the people who was most intrigued by this, troubled by it, and determined to get to the bottom of it was the well-known author Stieg Larsson, well-known, of course, as the author of such books as The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It turns out that when Stieg Larsson died, he left behind him an enormous archive, which represented the extensive research and study and exploration that he had done behind the mystery of the Palme assassination. And much of what Stieg Larsson discovered, uncovered, explored, has been released to the world thanks to a gifted Swedish writer and journalist by the name of Jan Stocklasa. And he has released to the world, first of all, a bestseller called Stieg Larsson's Archive, The Key to the Palme Murder, and a more recent book now called The Man Who Played with Fire, Stieg Larsson's Lost Files and the Hunt for an Assassin. And I'm excited that we can have Jan Stocklasa with us to talk about this book and to briefly at least talk about his intriguing career, which has included a great deal of other work and an exploration of various conspiracies in the world of international politics. Jan Stocklasa, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to be here.
I learned such a great deal from reading your book about the assassination of Prime Minister Palme back in 1986, and I'm sort of embarrassed to think that I took so little notice of that event at the time that it occurred, and there is much that makes it, of course, very troubling. Tell us first, because you write about this to some extent in the book, about what Prime Minister Palme was like as a leader, and in a sense sort of his mixed image, the way in which he was on the one hand popular, on the other hand someone with plenty of enemies.
Yeah, Olof Palme was definitely the biggest statesman of Sweden in the 20th century, maybe ever. Some people actually said that he was too big for Sweden, and that's why he was also quite disliked in Sweden. Many people loved him, and the other half actually disliked him and even hated him, so there were campaigns run against him. And that was the same thing on the international scene. The small countries, the third world countries, they loved him because he stood up for them. The superpowers, the Soviet Union and the USA, they had troubles with him because he kept criticizing them all the time.
You tell us in a book, in a chapter called The Opposition, that Palme's political philosophy was referred to as the third way. Can you just say a quick word about what that term represents?
It represented that there was something between pure capitalism and pure socialism, that there was a way for the small countries of the world to actually to deliver a system that would help and take care of also of the weaker groups of the society, and that they could also stand up against the superpowers of the world. And that was what he was actually fighting for, at the same time when the Cold War actually was coming to an end.
You tell us also that when it came to those who disliked him or opposed him, that as far as you're concerned, at least, it was not primarily his politics. You say it had a lot to do with his own background and also his exceptional intelligence that, in a sense, made him an inviting target. Tell us more about this facet of who he was that made him as intently disliked as he was by at least some people.
Well, he was from the upper class, and he switched camps. So he went over to and became the leader of the Social Democratic Party, the Workers' Party of Sweden. In that sense, he was a traitor of his class. So they didn't like him for that reason. When he came to his new camp, he was actually viewed as arrogant. He was extremely intelligent. He had an IQ of 160. And so he was actually one of the most intelligent and most well-spoken people. But he was also came out as arrogant in many debates and actually humiliated some of his opponents. So he became disliked in those that camp too.
So take us back, if you would, to February 28th, 1986, and what we know, which unfortunately is not very much, about what unfolded on that night.
So it was a windy, cold Friday evening when the Palmer couple, Olof Palme and his wife, decided to go to a movie theater. And the late show started at 9 p.m., so they left home around 8 p.m. And called off the bodyguards. They entered the cinema, came out 2 hours later, a lot of time for someone to prepare, and then started walking home in this cold, windy evening. A few hundred yards later, a man stepped up and put one shot in the back of our prime minister, and before he fell to the ground, he was dead.
You tell us that it was not strange that the prime minister had called off his security detail. I mean, in effect, I suppose, sent them home. This was apparently very typical of him under these kind of circumstances, that he was often walking the streets unguarded, as it were. So in a sense, nothing should be read into the fact that he was not guarded that night. Is that right?
That's correct. He was had been threatened for actually the last two decades of his life, and sometimes he wanted to feel like a normal citizen. And he also believed that in Sweden, a bit naive, he thought that he would nothing would ever happen to him. That proved wrong.
Absolutely, and of course, one of the most interesting things is to try to understand how not only the city of Stockholm, but all of Sweden was thrown into huge shock at this incident. One of the things that you describe in your book is what that scene was like the day after, when, for instance, Mr. Larsson reaches the spot where the assassination takes place. You say they were struck by the silence. 100 people were gathered around the little blocked-off area. No one was gesturing or moving around. No one spoke audibly. Those who were crying did so silently. It was a Swedish way of showing grief. People came, some with a rose in their hands, and people went, but it all happened in silence. And this happened, of course, with no immediate suspect in hand, and with every passing day it became clear that this was going to be a murder that would not be easily or quickly solved, and maybe would not ever be solved. Tell us about the extraordinary archive of materials that you were able to access that began the odyssey that led to this book. Describe this odyssey, where it was housed, and the sort of the dimensions of it.
Well, first, I love your description of it and the way that you described that actually moment. It was, I would say, that was the JFK moment of Sweden. Probably every American remembers what he or she did at the time when JFK was killed, and that's the case of Olof Palme in Sweden also. Mm. So that's the thing, and the murder still remains unsolved 3 decades later. And some 5 years ago, I managed to track down and realize that there existed a forgotten archive by our crime writer, Stieg Larsson. And
I was wondering, how did you know about it, or how did you come to even realize that such a thing existed?
I was actually going to write a completely different book. I wasn't even very interested in our murder, the murder of our prime minister. I wasn't very interested in the person, Stieg Larsson, at the time. But I was doing research, and I found a paper in an archive, and it said, talked about the alleged middleman in the murder of our prime minister. And I asked the lady who had the archive who wrote this, and she said, Stieg Larsson. And that was the inciting moment. That was one of those moments that changes your life.
Right. So describe kind of the dimensions of this archive, I mean, and the kind of materials in it, which you had to sort through and explore over the course of quite a long period of time.
Well, when I came there, it was this iron sheet door in a storage facility, rented storage facility, and I thought maybe there will be a small pile or a box full of papers. And the door rolled up, and suddenly there were 20 boxes full of documents, memos, and letters, and articles. And it felt like I stepped into a candy store as a small boy, and they just told me, you can eat anything.
Mm. Although you couldn't take anything away, at least initially, all of your inspection had to be done on site.
Yeah, that was it. I sat down there, and it felt like it was only 5 minutes, but I sat the whole day in this very sterile environment and just read and read and tried to find the thread that Stieg Larsson was following.
It seems to me that your book is, in a sense, about two different things simultaneously. It is the story of trying to unravel this really troubling mystery of who exactly murdered Prime Minister Palme and why. But it's also the story of Stieg Larsson's efforts to get at that answer. And in a sense, it's the same thing, but it's two different things. It's two different stories. And I think that's one of the things that makes this book especially interesting. Was that your intention?
Yeah, I think that anybody, Stieg Larsson and even I, when you start looking at, I use the word obsessed, when you get obsessed of something like that, it becomes your life for a while. And you stay in that bubble. And you can't stay too long. If you stay too long, you get crazy. And I've spent almost a decade on this, and now I'm going to the next story, you would say. So I think you're right. It's about the person also, very much, and the actual case.
And of you mentioned, I believe in the acknowledgments, that you never actually had the opportunity to meet Stieg Larsson himself, but you certainly have come to meet many people who were close to him. And I suspect even in the exploration of these archives, you have something of a sense of who he was and what he was like.
Yeah, I feel like I know him. I've sort of filled out all the gaps around him, so I see the picture of him. I know his living partner, Eva Gabrielsson, really well. We've become friends. And several of his friends also. So the picture is quite clear, also by reading his books now, but I just never met him.
Right. And a last question. We don't want to betray anything in terms of conclusions that you might have drawn, but you make it very clear that law enforcement has taken notice of this book and of the material that it contains, and you are really hopeful that someday someone will be brought to justice for this crime.
Yeah, the police asked me to hand in the book before it was published, and I wrote to them on the first page, here you have the manual to solve the killing. And since then, we met five or six times. They've asked to meet me, and I truly believe that this will be solved in 1 or 2 years' time. Mm-hmm.
The book again is titled The Man Who Played with Fire, Stieg Larsson's Lost Files and the Hunt for an Assassin. The author, Jan Stocklasa, this book available through Amazon Crossing. Jan Stocklasa, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book, and best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. Good talking to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, I'll be replaying my conversation with author Craig Nelson and his nearly definitive book about the attack on Pearl Harbor. Also, I'll replay a portion of a more recent interview with the author of Our Man in Tokyo, which tells the story of America's ambassador to Japan during those tumultuous years leading up to the Second World War. On Thursday and Friday, we'll be devoting The Morning Show to previewing upcoming events, here in southeastern Wisconsin, including this weekend's concerts by the Kenosha Symphony and Kenosha Pops Concert Band, as well as the current production of the Racine Theater Guild, the musical The Little Mermaid. The morning show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Cloudy skies today and tonight. A chance of some rain this afternoon. Today's high, 42 degrees. Overnight low of 31. Some sunshine tomorrow with a high of 43 degrees. With a chance of some rain redeveloping Thursday night into Friday morning. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.